Welcome to Vox Lab, the podcast series of Precision Talks, and listen to the voices of the scientists working towards precision toxicology to better protect human health and the environment.
Welcome to this episode of Vox Lab, the podcast by Precision Talks. I'm today with Thomas Dickmeys from KIT. Hello, Thomas.
Hello, nice having me.
Thank you for being with us today. And the topic of today is going to be the zebrafish, Daniel Rario, an organism species that we use in Precision Talks with four others as well as human cell lines. And Thomas has been working on this fascinating organism species for quite some time now, and is going to introduce us to this particular organism species. Thank you again, Thomas, for accepting this invitation. Can you describe this Daniel Rario? How does he live? Where does he live? In what environment? What does he eat? How does he reproduce?
So I think it will probably be familiar to quite a number of people because it's a very popular aquarium fish, actually, also especially for beginners, because they're quite easy to keep. So and they're quite popular. So they are small sweetwater fishes that come originally from India. So they're in many areas of the Indian subcontinent, you can find them. They are about 2-3 centimeters in length. They have stripes, horizontal stripes that give them the name zebrafish, right? So for a zebra, it should rather be vertical stripes, but still the name sticks. they live in river basins, not really in the main river, but rather in the secondary or tertiary channels that connect with the main river basin, or in swamp areas, also in rice fields, for example. Actually, the name, the Latin name Danio, refers to a Bengal word, I believe, that refers to the green color of these rice fields. So this is also where the name comes from. Yeah, so it lives in these sweetwater habitats that usually also are characterized by overhanging vegetation. And this is actually interesting because it leads us to what they eat in these habitats, because often they eat insects that fall into the water from the overhanging vegetation. And you can see already in the morphology of the fish, you will notice that the mouth is directed upwards. And this actually is a sign that they like to feed at the surface. So they're really a bit fixed on what might fall into the water from above, which is also what you see, of course, if you put flakes into the aquarium, you will observe exactly the same behavior. And then they also chase plankton across any depths of water. So they're also hunters. They like to go after, for example, little crustacean larvae and things like this. So this is what they eat also in the lab. In the lab, we also feed them with little crustacean larvae, Artemia larvae, that we breed in the lab for them. And they really like this. If you throw this into the water, they go crazy and chase after them like anything. Yeah. They are, of course, also eaten by other animals. So there are a couple of other fish species that appear to feed on zebrafish in the wild. And the smaller, the larvae, for example, they can be fed on by large insect larvae, of like libellula larvae, that are actually big enough even to eat juvenile fish of this smaller size. So this is the typical situation where you would find zebrafish as a prey and not as a raptor, so to speak. Yeah.
Zebrafish are today widely used by scientists in labs. What makes it an interesting model for scientists to study?
Yes, and so why they became popular in the lab is actually to a large part due to the easy husbandry. So it's very easy to keep them and to breed them in captivity as well. So this is not so complicated. But there are other features that make them a very well-suited animal for research, especially initially used mainly for developmental biology, because it has transparent embryos where you can actually observe in the living animal how organs develop. So that was a very useful feature for embryology, to understand how cells move in an embryo, how they assemble into organs. And another feature is that there are, thanks to the work to the pioneering work of George Streisinger at the end of the 70s, beginning of the 80s, there are also a number of genetic tricks available that could be used in the beginning to carry out genetic screens in this animal, where you would be able to mutagenize a fish and then look in the progeny for defects in development. And the breeding schemes and some other tricks that George Streisinger developed made this very easily feasible. And this would actually allow you to do types of genetic screens that up to then were only feasible in Drosophila, but now in a vertebrate animal. So you call it the fly of the vertebrate, so to speak. And this, for example, led in the mid 90s to the publication of an entire issue of the journal Development that was filled with zebrafish mutants, probably several hundreds, if not thousands of them that were described there for the first time, and that we actually still work with, because there are many, many aspects of organ development, of early development, where you can have animals that carry defects in genes that then lead to a perturbation of particular aspects of these developments. So fish that do not develop blood correctly, for example, or fish that lack a liver, fish that lack a heart, things like these aspects that you can see.
So zebrafish is very easy to maintain and to study in the lab, but by studying it, what are researchers trying to discover in particular? It is used in toxicology and ecotoxicology. What can this organism model teach us?
Yes, sure. So ecotoxicology or toxicology is what we are doing in our consortium now. As I said, initially, the initial interest was development. It was development of vertebrates. So there are many features that the zebrafish developmental processes share with that also of the so-called higher vertebrates. So patterning, early patterning of the embryo, for example, there are the same types of genes involved. And actually, anyway, the zebrafish has about 70% identity, or 70% of human genes have at least one orthologue also in the zebrafish. So one similar gene in the zebrafish. And this comes actually to 80% if you look at human disease genes. And here comes now, of course, a second reason why it is so interesting to work with zebrafish from a biomedical reason. So you can study many aspects of disease also in this little model organism, taking advantage, especially again, of the screening possibilities. For example, you can screen, you can generate a zebrafish model, a genetic zebrafish model for a particular disease. And then due to this high fecundity, the small size of the embryos and larvae, you can actually do pharmaceutical screens, compound screens, chemical screens, to identify then substances that may actually relieve certain features of the disease model that we have generated. So this is something, the screening possibilities are something that have raised a big interest in, especially also in drug development. So because you can screen for the effect of a drug in a whole organism, something that, and you can use essentially the infrastructure that has been generated for cell culture, like that has been used also for decades already using cell culture models, but you can use the same setup, so to speak, to look at the whole organism. And thereby you capture like interaction between organs, you capture metabolization of drugs in the organism, and that only then would have an effect, either positive or negative. So negative effect is the toxicology aspect. This is why we're interested in the toxicology. So you can see harmful effects of substances. Also very specifically, you can look whether the liver is damaged, you can look at kidney damages, you can look at heart damages, brain damages that are caused by certain substances, and thereby have a whole spectrum of, like we call it, readouts of harmful effects of compounds on these animals. And due to the similarity with the with mammals in many aspects, you will be able to extrapolate that such harmful effects may also occur in mammals.
In the project, we are using embryos, right? And that's the reason why we call this model a 3R compliant model. So this 3R stands for replacement, reduction, and refinement of the use of animals in research. So we are using embryos.
What does this imply? Can you describe this development phase, and how long does it last, and how scientists are tapping on the use of embryo to learn more on humans and other animal health.
Yeah. So generally, we would say an animal in the course of development, an animal becomes an animal also in the legal sense of the term as soon as it starts feeding. And the reason for this is that it is assumed that once the animal is autonomously feeding, it also has generated like a sort of a worldview, so to speak, that may give it at least a way of perceiving the environment that may include also the perception of harmful stimuli. So this is, so one would assume then with the start of this feeding behavior, you would also have a higher likelihood that the animal may actually perceive pain or may suffer when treated with harmful substances. And so in the zebrafish, this is the case at around 120 hours post-fertilization. They will hatch about on the third day of development, but then they are still completely dependent on their yolk. So they don't swim so much. They still sit around mainly, and they're happily using up their yolk until at the end of the fourth day, they will start to become looking for food also actively, and will begin then in the course of this fifth day to capture prey and feed also on prey. And then towards the eighth day of development, then the yolk is really completely depleted and they have become completely dependent on external food, more or less. Yeah. But yeah, so the reason is we can use the animals until this fifth day, because until then they are not really actively hunting for food yet. And still we have already, because there is already digestion going on, but digestion of the yolk, we have already functional organ systems that we can look at, right? Like the kidney I mentioned, the liver is already there, heart is there, pancreas is there, things like this, yeah, which makes it still a very useful model also at this early stage, even though it is not considered sentient at this early stage of development. Yeah.
And also the fact that it's a very small embryo, right? It's few millimeters. So you can generate a high number of embryos and so generate a high throughput testing, right?
Yes, a couple of fish will lay about 300 eggs in one single breeding. Yeah. So this is very nice. Then you have a high number of synchronously developing animals that are also genetically then quite homogeneous because they're brothers and sisters essentially. And this is also useful for certain aspects of statistics, for example, that you would like to see. So you will also be able to see rare effects of drugs, for example, or rare effects of mutations also in certain genes that may be overlooked in mammals. For example, for mice, you may have like six pups. And if you have like an effect of a perturbed gene expression in that only leads to a visible change in the animal in about 2% of the cases, you will never see it, or you will see it only if you breed really a high number of mice. Whereas in the zebrafish, you will be able to evaluate these types of changes as well. Yeah.
Not only the zebrafish embryos allows to have a very high number of data, and to have more data than if we're just using rodents, but also in a shorter time, if we are exposing them for a few days, you have the data pretty as compared to rodents that will take a few years, right, for instance?
Yes, so if you're looking at acute effects of toxicants, for example, you will be able to look at any time between 1 and 5 days, of course, and look at certain aspects of development. You can also look at the later stages of development only, like in our consortium, we are starting the treatment at 3 days post-fertilization that go then for 2 days of treatment. You can also do transgenerational studies, but there the zebrafish, it needs 3 months until it reaches sexual maturity. So there it is actually not so such a big advantage compared to mice, for example, right? So it takes, if you really need to breed to adulthood, it takes a bit of time. Yeah. But this is also possible, and still it is, of course, easier to use more animals and also in this way detect more subtle defects than you would be able to do with mammals. Yeah. But one of the, I think one of the main advantages in toxicology is indeed that in the embryos already you can screen in an organism. So you will see effects on certain organs, or you will see effects of metabolization of compounds that can then help you to more precisely target any follow-up studies that you would need to carry out in the mammalian system, right? So you're not really walking around in the dark there, but you can really plan, okay, I want to look, I have already, based on the zebrafish data, I have the suspicion there must be some kidney toxicity. And then you look directly, is this also the case in a rat, for example? And you don't need to go through all these long and costly experiments that you would have to do otherwise if you had this, if you didn't have this information, right?
So in Precision Talk, the goal is to test 250 chemicals on the five organism models that we have, and to have a comparison on the data to validate methods to replace and accelerate the chemical safety assessment. At what stage are we at the moment on your side with zebrafish? What are the chemicals that you are using at this stage trying to test on zebrafish?
We are at the stage at the moment. So we have chosen five compounds for a pilot study, actually. This included two heavy metals and three organic compounds that were targeting specific pathways of signaling pathways inside the organism. And we have now completed these studies already. So what we do essentially is that we initially we carry out a range finding study where we aim to find the concentration of the compound that will not lead to a too strong toxicity yet, because what we're interested in capturing in the transcriptomics and metabolomics parts of the project, where we look at gene expression changes and at metabolite or metabolism changes in the animals, we want to capture really early events that are triggering downstream effects that then may lead to the harmful effects that we observe in the animals. So we're trying not to dose too hard, because if we kill them like within minutes, so to speak, we would get only genes that are involved in this overt toxicity. And these are fairly well known already. And so it's not the interesting part. What we're really interested is in specific aspects that then trigger harmful downstream effects. So therefore, we carry out this range finding study where we try to find a concentration where, say, 10% of the animals will develop some harmful signs of toxicity or harm. In our case, as a readout, what we use is motility. This is in part chosen because it's easy to measure in an automated way, and also because the other models also use this readout as the main readout. So, so we will capture with this, of course, compounds that kill the embryos, so they will not move anymore if they're dead. But we will also capture things that may interfere with the neuromuscular system, right? So things that like would lead to a paralysis of the muscles, or that interfere with nervous system function, they may also harm these this readout and lead to effects in this readout. And we're doing this with a behavior of the late embryo, which is called the startle response. So it will react with a certain sequence of movements that like is like sort of a reflective swimming away an escape response, so to speak, to vibrations in the water. So we put the plates with 20 of these embryos onto a loudspeaker, essentially, then give a very deep sound so that the water vibrates, and then observe the movement of the embryos in the dish, and then count the ones that do not move anymore. And this is then our readout. Yeah? So this is essentially how this is carried out. So once we have identified this concentration at which we want to treat, we will then use this concentration to do a time course analysis over the 2 days of exposure, where we would take like initially five time points, one quite close to the the beginning of the treatment, and the other is a bit more towards the end of the treatment, and take samples at this time point that we freeze in liquid nitrogen and then ship over to our colleagues in Birmingham, where the analysis of mRNA expression and of metabolites will be carried out. And this is essentially the procedure that is carried out with all the model organisms and cell culture studies inside within the consortium. And we hope from this to be able to identify phylogenetically conserved pathways that actually trigger toxicity, and use this then as a prediction tool for toxicity also in humans and other mammals.
And this will ultimately, I mean, the hope and the goal, the ambition is to ultimately being able to find a variation in susceptibility and being more sure of the exposure level for safety exposure level, right?
Exactly, yes. But also what we also hope to see, at least for some of the compounds, is whether we can find things that are toxic, for example, for arthropods, but not for vertebrates, right? So these are things that are, of course, also of interest, because this is then not so much seen from a human toxicology viewpoint, which is the main aim of the project. Like, we want to predict toxicity for humans using it, but it's a sort of a nice side effect, because you would also see effects that are toxic in arthropods, and that may, of course, cause huge ecological problems. Like, we know about the decline of insect populations worldwide that are due to very much suspected pesticide use. But there may be other substances as well that contribute to this, and this may be yet another way how we can find such substances and also understand why they affect arthropods as opposed to other animals, for example. And this understanding may help us to design new compounds that still are effective for what we want them to do, but that avoid this specific type of toxicity to arthropods then. Insects and crustaceans.
So you are referring to what you call toxicology by descent, and the fact that, yes, the ambition of the project is not only to see the effects of chemicals on human health, but it can be applied to any other animals, thanks to the comparison of these five organism species that we have in the project, plus human cells. So ultimately to accelerate and improve environmental health protection. This is the goal of the project. What are the results that you expect at the end of the project, Thomas?
I hope we will have a really large map of compound effects on the transcriptional and metabolic landscapes in these different organisms. That will help us to identify how toxicity by certain compounds is caused, right? And to really understand, get to a more mechanistic understanding of what is happening and which of these pathways we can, on the one hand, use as a warning sign, so to speak, that if you see when you're testing for certain compounds, you should test that these particular branches of pathways are activated. This is already a sign, okay, there may be something going wrong. So you would get a set of biomarkers that would allow you to diagnose whether some toxicity is taking place. But it would hopefully also help us to understand what precisely triggers these pathways in the compounds themselves, and thereby maybe avoid such features of compounds that are actually responsible for the toxicity. This is another aim, I would say, and I hope that at least for some compounds we may get actually to these information, to this information that we can then use for better design of compounds.
And this will ultimately help the regulators refine the risk regulation, for instance, in the EU. Maybe we can talk about other projects like AIT is doing with the zebrafish.
One aspect that we're looking at, this is something that I haven't mentioned. This is now not about the embryos, but about adult zebrafish. So adult zebrafish have another remarkable feature that also made them a very interesting model for biomedical studies. And that is a large or a really impressive regeneration capacity. So this is, if you cut a little bit of a zebrafish fin, it will regrow in no time, right? But this extends actually to if you cut away about up to a third of the heart, also the heart will regrow. If you step a needle into the brain of the zebrafish, it will most of all, the most surprising thing is that it doesn't really notice this so much, because once it wakes up from anesthesia, it will swim around again and even start eating and quickly mating again. And this is regenerated in a couple of weeks as well. So if you then would look into the brain, you would see that you would not be able to tell which half of the brain has been damaged. So these, another aspect is, this is not done by us, but by like the heart is also not done by us. We are concentrating on this telencephalon, so the forebrain damage. Yeah. But other groups are looking also at spinal cord damage. So you can actually cut the spinal cord and then they cannot swim for a while. But also this is regenerating very fast, and they actually will, it will grow back together and they are able to swim. So needless to say, this is of course a feature that is very interesting and that we would also as mammals would like to be able to do, right? Which we cannot do. And we would like to understand all this community of researchers looking at regeneration is why can the fish do this and why can't we? And behind this, of course, if we understand how they do it, will we be able to maybe trigger similar processes also in humans? Yeah. So this is one aspect, and we are interested here in one particular feature, which is the role that reactive oxygen species play in these processes. So this is one project that we're currently doing. When you mentioned the spinal cord damage, for example, this like this for people that have a section at the neck, for example, this is of course something that is the need to do these types of experiments is immediately obvious, right? So it's something that, especially since, as I just told, the fish, yeah, they suffer a bit, yes, of course, so they will not like being stabbed or something. But ethically balancing the two things, like the little bit of suffering that these fish have, which is limited because they, as I said, they are quite hardy and they will soon probably forget that they ever were stabbed, right? And the amount of information or the potential for information that we may get to really relieve human suffering, I think this is an important thing to consider. People are also working on regeneration of the pancreas, especially of the beta cells of the pancreas, which are the insulin producing cells. Of course, this is something very important for a major disease also many people suffer from, which is diabetes, right? And also here people are trying to take advantage of the genetic tricks and the screening possibilities that we have in this fish. So you can generate zebrafish in which by adding a particular drug, you will destroy cells that take up this drug, like the beta cells, for example. In these cells, you express a certain enzyme that takes the drug and then turns it into a toxin. So it kills those cells in which this particular gene is expressed. And so in this way, you can ablate specifically beta cells in the pancreas, and you get an embryo that lacks these beta cells. And then you stop the treatment with this drug, and then it will start to regrow. And now you can do a drug screening where you add other compounds, and you can see which of these compounds actually accelerate this recovery, or which block it, or which maybe even lead to certain aspects of this regeneration. So like a combination of the genetic tools with the screening tools that we have available in this model. And this is again something that you can get candidate substances that you can then use and test in mammals, whether they have similar effects also in mammalian systems and in humans ultimately, of course. But so this is also an aspect of the model that I think is quite important, which is why it has attracted a lot of medical interest as well. Yeah.
That's fascinating, Thomas. Thank you very much for all this information. Is there anything you want to add to conclude?
Yeah, so I hope that I sort of illustrated with a couple of examples why people especially in the biomedical and in the toxicology research community are so interested in a small sweetwater aquarium fish, right? And what this little fish can tell us about us in the end, and also how it can help us with many of the current problems of society, be they related to medicine, disease, or to environmental problems that we also have due to our lifestyle. So,
thank you very much, Thomas, for this this very interesting view into the world of zebrafish. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. It was a pleasure.
And looking forward to share more results with the scientific community with Precision Talks. Thank you very much again, Thomas. Thank you.
We hope you enjoyed this podcast. To learn more about Precision Toxicology and listen to the new episodes of VoxLam, visit our website, precisiontox.org, and follow us on Twitter at @PrecisionTalks. This project has received the financial support of the European Union's Horizon 2020 program. The content of this program only reflects the author's view. The EU cannot be held responsible for any information contained therein.